Signature support for Talk Louisiana comes from Brian Lowe Financial.
Welcome back to Talk Louisiana. This is Jan Swift, sitting in for Jim Inkster today. Our number is 877-217-5757. Dr. Sean Wilson, Secretary of the Louisiana Department of Transportation and Development, is our guest in this first segment. Sean was appointed by Governor John Bel Edwards on January 11, 2016, after more than 10 years of executive service at DOTD. Under Sean's leadership, DOTD has secured nearly $150 million of additional federal dollars for I-10 widening from I-49 to New Orleans, for the Baton Rouge I-10 bottleneck, and for the shortest design-build procurement in the state's history to widen I-10 from Highland Road to LA 73. In addition, DOTD has helped communities with alternative fuel transit assets, focused on advancing passenger rail, and helping launch bike share in Baton Rouge. Sean, I want to thank you for taking time to be on Talk Louisiana today.
Thank you, Jan, and good morning to your listeners.
Yeah, thank you for calling in. I know you're traveling today, and you missed the...
I'm in a snow globe in Minnesota, and it's absolutely gorgeous.
Oh, I bet.
I can't wait to get home.
It's raining here, and we had the typical traffic, you know, coming across the bridge and in Baton Rouge, but I made it safely. And I know you've got a lot to talk about our road conditions, help needed to pay for things. Where would you like to jump in today?
Well, it's your call. We can start talking about the most important thing, and you mentioned it, the congestion and how that translates to safety. I think it's important for folks to know that we're on a good path of improving our numbers for vehicle accidents and deaths on our roads, but it's still far too high. We've got over 650 deaths this year alone. And around the country, we've had 37,000 people die a year on our highways. And imagine, you know, with three plane crashes, what the reaction was for the nation. But that's what we lose every year, is 37,000 people, and it's just far too many. And so the most important thing is I would encourage folks to always recognize that safety is paramount. That's why you see the cable barriers. That's why you see rumble strips. That's why you see the safety barriers on our highways. And we need to really concentrate on minimizing distractions and inattentive driving. Phones, radios, kids, all of those things can be a distraction, but it only takes a second to change your life. So that's our most important mission at the Department of Transportation.
You know, you're saying that accidents have gone down overall in the state, but it seems like in the Lafayette area, in our region, we've had so many accidents, hit and runs. And do you attribute it to the use of cell phones? Is that what one of the biggest issues is?
You know, we used to say initially when there were accidents, it was drunk driving. Now the go-to answer is distracted driving. And in most cases, that will be a cell phone. Now, it's hard to document until you go through some adjudication or investigatory process that you're going to check to see if that phone was being used at the exact time of the accident. But it's still far too many. And unfortunately, while the numbers are going down in terms of deaths, that's not necessarily accidents, but that's deaths specifically. We are seeing an increase in the number of pedestrians that are being killed in our state. In many cases, it's because they're distracted as well when they're walking using their cell phones, or there may be in a dark area and aren't paying attention. That's a big issue for us. Right. And, you know, we have a goal of getting to destination zero deaths in the state of Louisiana, and we've got a long way to go, but we are constantly making progress.
Right. Well, I know there's a lot of construction going on. As I left Lafayette this morning, you know, I went through all the widening that's happening in the Breaux Bridge area. You want to talk about that and maybe what the timeline is for people that travel in that part of the state?
Sure. So, you know, that project is one that people don't realize it, but we are replacing original pavement. It was some of the worst pavement on I-10. It was actually built over 50-plus years ago. And in order for us to rebuild that road, we had to maintain two lanes of traffic because it's an interstate. And that's why we have the additional lane, so that we can move traffic over while we rebuild the original lanes. And we're building it with a much wider shoulder and, of course, that big safety barrier in the median, which is going to prevent cross-median collisions that always end up in a death once there's an impact. That project is going along very well. We broke ground on it in 2016. We received a fast lane grant for it from the previous administration, and it's moved along very well. We expect to be finished with both of the sections that are under construction in the summer of 2020. And we've already let the section in the middle connecting Brobridge to Henderson. And that project will take about 2.5 years to construct as well. And at the end of the day, we will have spent over $185 million in that corridor alone to make it more efficient, make it safer, and improve the pavement condition for travelers, particularly those that are in trucks and RVs. And if you look along that stretch, you see tremendous economic development and prosperity that's come, not as a direct result of that, but it's attributed to that because people need to have access and need to have mobility and get to certain points. And I'm very proud of that project and everything else that it's precipitated along the highway system for us. Mm-hmm.
You know, as a Tiger fan, we come over here quite often and love the Baton Rouge area. And out of any project in the state, I really want to see it easier to get to Baton Rouge, to get across that bridge. I know there's a lot going on. I'm not up to speed on where we are in working on the Mississippi River Bridge and, you know, coming into to Baton Rouge as you exit the,
sure,
the bridge.
So what I will tell you is we've got a couple of things, and it's a major undertaking that we're about to embark on. One, because that's the one stretch where Interstate 10 becomes one lane, which is really a disastrous design mm-hmm. from when the interstate was originally built. But we've done a couple of things. One, we've designed and constructed and opened the Washington Terrace Street off-ramp, which will allow that very dangerous three-lane merge to exit to take place further north on 110. And we have found a way. Fortunately, Governor Edwards supported us doing something we've had the authority to do for years but never did it, and that was use Garvey Bonds. And Garvey Bonds are going to provide the financial tool for us to complete this entire corridor from 415 to the bridge to the 1012 split. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be a widening, and it's going to come really right under, right at $1 billion, we think. But at the end of the day, if we don't get started, we'll never get finished. And you don't have to have 100% of the money up front to get started because of the nature of construction. So we have just completed our final public meeting and received all of our public comments for the widening from the bridge all the way to the 1012 split. And there's several projects in there. What folks need to understand is the bridge over the lakes is only three lanes with no shoulders. And you're merging four lanes into that pinch point, and then you get to a little wider section that has three lanes. And so the goal is not necessarily to widen the bridge, but to allow for more throughput from 415 mm-hmm. to LA1 and have a much more efficient on and off ramp process, and then to be able to pull traffic through from the bridge all the way to the 1012 split. And so we will be adding a lane in each direction in that stretch. We have 95% of the right-of-way. Most of the right-of-way that we're going to have to acquire is going to be at the interchanges. And then we've already started the design build for another critical factor. One is the elevation of the ramp under the railroad tracks, as well as the elevation of the tracks on Acadian, which will help with flooding. And we're doing the college westbound flyover, which is going to allow folks traveling on I-10 who want to get off on College to be able to exit much sooner. And that's going to eliminate a very unsafe merge for those who are traveling on both 10 and 12. That project is actually in procurement. And for the first time, these projects are funded before we are going out the door with them. And, you know, we've attempted to do this project for the last 20 years. And I am so fortunate mm-hmm. and grateful that we've had the tenacity and wherewithal to stick to it, bring innovation to the process. This will be our state's first CMAR project, which is an interesting procurement method where the engineering firm works directly for the state, and then we bring a contractor in much earlier to make sure that we're designing things that are constructible and affordable and are going to move in that methodical fashion. Mm-hmm. And so it should allow for us to have some additional value and savings in what we're building. So it's not going to happen quick. The fact that that corridor is 60 years old, 55, 60 years old, is an indication that if we don't do it now, you'll have to do it later. And the longer we wait, the more expensive it gets. And more importantly, you might not be able to control your own destiny in terms of how you take it down and rebuild it. So
right.
We are very much moving forward on that project in a very thoughtful and best practice way. This is what's happening around the country. And, you know, we are going to make the best of it and make that community where it sits a lot better than it was than when it built it the first time.
Right. Sean, we have less than a minute before our break. I wanted to ask you, with all this enhancement of our roads, it always disrupts people. You know, are people pretty much happy in the Baton Rouge area about these improvements that proposed and in the works, or how is it received when they find out that they're in the path of a project?
I think this project is much bigger than just Baton Rouge because it has over 100,000 cars a day. So we can talk more about it after the break.
All right. Thank you. Anyone wanting to call in, you can call us at 877-217-5757. We'll be right back. And we can talk with Sean Wilson for the last 10 minutes of this segment. And then we'll be welcoming Chris Russo-Blackwood. Thank you. Welcome back to Talk Louisiana. This is Jan Swift filling in for Jim Engster. And we have Secretary of the Department of Transportation, Sean Wilson, with us. If you'd like to talk with Sean, you can phone in at 877-217-5757. So, Sean, in our last 10 minutes, I know there's a lot you wanted to talk about. You want to talk about funding of roads, where we are, and, you know, maybe some of the efforts you'd like to see happen in this next term.
So let me just go back right quick to that question about are folks happy on on the I-10 project. I think there's confidence and trust that we're going to get it right the first time this time. And that the conditions of what we have now is unacceptable. And so with congestion, the additional time, the cost, the effect on our environment, the effect on that community, all of those are things that can improve, but it's going to have to take some time to get it right. We have so much more that we've learned how to do in terms of design and construction. And, you know, we will never have 100% support on anything that we do. But the vast majority of folks will tell you that the time is now to do that project. The time is now to do the new bridge. The time is now to really do all of the types of infrastructure projects that we've talked about for decades that we have not gotten, and we see our neighboring states all advancing. The transition to how you pay for this stuff, you know, we've worked very hard at what we did in 2017, and when the legislature opted not to advance a right-sizing of the gas tax, recognizing the fact that it hasn't increased for 30 plus years and that nobody can do today for the cost of what they were doing 30 years ago, whether it was radio airtime, clothing, food, your compensation. If we asked you to live off of an economy or a revenue stream of 1989, you could not effectively do it. That's what we're being asked to do in the state of Louisiana, knowing prices of infrastructure and everything increases. And so we turned our attention to doing the best we can, finding additional dollars at the federal level, of which we've achieved, using Garvey bonds, which is borrowing in a very responsible way from our future, in a way that's going to provide more value than the cost of the borrowing, and looking at tolling projects and other innovative delivery models. At the end of the day, it's about revenue, and it's about what you're going to put into the system to be able to produce the value. We've closed 44 bridges this year, and the governor supports infrastructure. He supports making investments. He signed the largest single investment with HB 578 last year, dedicating some of the BP money that was going to the states, not dedicated for recovery, but was economic impact on 10 projects in the state of Louisiana. So on every turn, he has made those right decisions. He is committed to working with whoever the leadership is in the House and the Senate once the new legislature comes together to say it can happen. We see that happening in Alabama. We see it in every other state. We have the third oldest gas tax in the country. And we realize that it can't happen with just a governor making a declaration. It's got to be a collective effort. And I think the citizens have spoken and said it's a very important issue. And so once we identify those leaders in the House and the Senate, and our chairman of transportation, we're going to try and have a discussion to see if we can do more for our citizens in terms of delivering on the system we have.
Well, good. What are some of the other projects? I know a lot of us want to see alternative transportation, and depending on the part of the state, I think some people are more amenable to having this, but I know that you're a proponent of light rail, more passenger options for people to get around, alternative fuel transit assets. Can you talk about that?
Sure. You know, as a precursor, I will tell you, the majority of what we do is always going to be roads and bridges, and I can't discount the fact that we've got 16,000 miles and 12,000 bridges that we have to maintain. That does not necessarily preclude us doing a new bridge in Baton Rouge, a Lake Charles bridge, I-49 South, the inner city connector. You name all of those big projects, we still have to do them. But we also have to figure out, how do I move more people through the highway system, through our right-of-way, to get people from point A to point B? And all around the country, we see passenger rail and light rail making a difference. One, because it's a great equalizer for opportunity and access, but two, it also produces economic value in the places where you build it. And so when you look at the transit-oriented development, when you look at the housing trends, when you look at the private investment that's generated, as well as the efficiency of moving from Baton Rouge to New Orleans, imagine being on a train and getting off at the airport, and imagine getting on a light rail system to get into the city of New Orleans. You could do that for less than it costs you to park for 8 hours in the city of New Orleans. Imagine the entertainment opportunities. Imagine the restaurants, the cleaners, the other services that are provided. And it's not just in that stretch. It's also across the northern part of the state. It's also through Lafayette. And you have to think about, what are other states doing that's generating enthusiasm and excitement around its people and its economy?
Right.
And transit-oriented development is one of them. That's what Uber's about. That is what the scooters are about. And that is what we have to start thinking about now. I'm not foolish enough to think that we're going to start building it next year. But imagine 55 years ago, if they said, we want to build an interstate through your state, if Louisiana said no, where would we be?
Right.
You would have no I-10, you'd have no I-12, you'd also not have an I-20, and you wouldn't have the economies that have been created because of those things. I suggest to you that we can no longer afford to build out the system further. We have to figure out how to maximize the system we have and move people in a much more efficient way.
I agree. We need to be more creative. And we do have a caller on line one. Bill has called in.
Hello. I just wanted to point out that there's a lot of discussion in the gubernatorial election about DOTD not spending enough money on fixing the roads and having too many personnel, that kind of stuff. And, you know, there's a lot of things that go on, very important things, before you ever, bus sod or start laying concrete. Information technology, financial systems, and the planning that goes on to make. And I just thought the secretary ought to take the opportunity to talk about how important all those things are. It's not just about concrete.
Thank you, Bill.
No, I would agree with you, Bill. I think your name was Bill. I apologize if I'm incorrect, but you're absolutely right. Projects just don't happen. They just don't come out of the blue. The vast majority of what we build in the state of Louisiana, we've contracted out. Most of the maintenance is occurring with our own forces. And it's important to note that we're down over 1,000 people from when I first started at the department approximately 15, 16 years ago, with only 4,200 people. And we have the 10th largest system of transportation in the country. And we have one of the smaller departments in the country. You also have to think about, what are we using to take care of our system? And some of the equipment that we have is older than some of the people that are riding on it. This idea of technology and advancement, we are huge in trying to do that, but those are things that cost. When you're looking at traffic systems, we do a phenomenal job with investing in trying to move people and provide more information on congestion and get the throughput. But at the end of the day, you have to really think about, what business is running on the resources of 30 years ago? And those resources applied to both internal and external. It applies to your materials. It applies to your operations, because we follow the rules of government. We do exactly as the budget that's allocated and approved by the legislature allows us to do. The challenges that we have is catching up, because we've not been able to keep up with inflation. At the end of the day, if you give me a dollar, 10 years, that dollar is only going to be worth maybe 70 cents or 80 cents, and then 10 more years, it'll be worth 50 cents. That's where we are with what we're investing with our system. And we can no longer do it when the vast majority of states in this country have all increased their gas taxes over 27, 28 states since 2012. And I keep talking about revenue. While we have a significant budget, we also have greater needs. And so, you know, the reality is we've committed to putting more dollars into the process to produce the projects that are necessary. We have the staff to be able to do that. We have the ability to contract those sources out. And at the end of the day, it's got to be more than a talking point. You've got to really look at the systems that you have and the resources that you're putting into it to determine the output that you're going to get. And if you're satisfied with the system we have today, keep it. And if not, do something different than what you've always done before. And cutting it is not the way to go.
Sean, thank you. And Bill, thank you for calling in. I want to thank Secretary of the Department of Transportation, Sean Wilson, for joining us today. And Sean, we had a couple of other callers that were on the line. I'll try to find out what they were calling about, and we will get back with you. Welcome back to Talk Louisiana. This is Jan Swift, filling in for Jim Inkster. Chris Russo-Blackwood is our guest in this segment. A journalist who started her career at The Advocate, Chris founded In Register magazine in 1989, where she served as editor for 20 years. Her book, My Brother's Keeper, A 20-Year Quest to Bring Two Killers to Justice, chronicles the incredible story of our mutual friend Ted Kergan, who devoted his life and over $1 million of his own money to hire a search and rescue organization and private investigators, among other resources, to find Gary Kergan, his missing brother and business partner. Following a career-long path of entrepreneurship, Chris's latest endeavor is Russo Ross, a boutique featuring clothing for women who weren't born yesterday. Now, Chris, I was born the day before yesterday, so I'm thrilled to be here hosting Talk Louisiana with you. Welcome to the show.
What a great reunion. Great to see you again and hear you again.
Well, you know, for those that aren't here with us, I kind of fugabooed Chris, and I brought some pictures of our days at LSU. We were sorority sisters in Delta Gamma. And I pulled up our mugs from 1975.
So. And I must say, Jan, you look exactly the same.
Yeah, of course I do.
Well, nobody can dispute that on the radio, right?
Right. And I want to say for the first segment listeners, thank you. This is my first time being on the radio with a live call-in show. And Jim makes it sound and look so easy.
Doesn't he?
For those of you that have never done this, it's luckily we've got Matthew here in the studio making everything happen. But I'm learning as I go, and I'm having a great time. Thank you for being here.
Oh, happy to be here.
Yeah. So for anybody that would like to talk with Chris, our number is 877-217-5757. And why don't we talk about your early career and what led you here? You were a reporter with The Advocate.
Yes, I started in the lifestyle section, which was then called the people section. And my editor there was Wanda Horn. And as we began to attend events in Baton Rouge, we saw there were so many things that the daily newspaper just couldn't cover. And so we broke out in 1989 and started In Register as a city social publication. Mm-hmm. And we were there for Wanda, of course, died in 1997, but I was there until I sold to Louisiana Business, mm-hmm. Publishers of the Business Report in 225 in 2009. So I guess, you know, that's the journalism part of my career. I also have a master's degree in clothing and textiles.
Oh, okay.
And so my leap into retail wasn't quite so crazy. I opened Russo Ross with Susan Ross in 2012. So we've been in business almost 9 years, 8.5 years, and are located on Jefferson at Renwood.
Yeah, so for people that haven't been there, it really is for women that want, you know, more kind of sophisticated and age appropriate.
Exactly.
Whatever
that
is.
That's what when we started talking, Susan had done quite a bit of styling as fashion styling as art director at In Register. And we talked all the time that we felt there was a lack of variety in clothing for women of a certain age, say over 40, wanting to be fashionable, but as you say, age appropriate. And so we just decided, well, let's just try it. Yeah. And so here we are, and it's been a great ride.
You were out for, I guess, a couple of decades, excuse me, covering social events. So you probably saw people dressed from the most appropriate to the least appropriate. Did that give you some ideas about what you wanted to sell? Like, have you learned as you went, or did you always feel like you kind of knew?
Well, it did in a way. So certainly I was familiar with a great number of events and what people were looking for to wear to these events. However, we held several focus groups, Susan and I did, before we opened the magazine, and that really opened our eyes because we found out a lot of things. You know, I love shopping, so it's fun to me. But for a lot of people, it's a very emotional experience. A lot of people don't like it. Mm-hmm. They want help, which is great because, you know, we offer a lot of things. You know, if you go into a bigger store or, you know, God forbid, you're shopping online and not local, you don't get that help. So you make a lot of mistakes if you're not familiar with, you know, how you look in certain clothing and fashion itself, right. Fabrics. There's a lot that goes into it. Fashion, fabrics, fit. And we get in the dressing room with women, and it's remarkable how they open up and, really, our bodies change. And even though we may even weigh the same, things aren't quite distributed the same way. So it's really eye-opening, and it's really a neat experience to be able to find clothing for women who were not excited about shopping, and now they are.
How has the online shopping affected you? I know you give that personal service. I don't really know if I could order clothes online. I want to know that it fits. I don't want to get it and then have to mail it back. But I know your focus is probably on helping people, like you said, figure out, does this look right for me and does it really fit?
Well, and you make a good point about the fit, and also pretty much hand in hand with that are the fabrics. I know before I even opened a boutique, of course, I love clothes always. Mm-hmm. I would shop by feeling things and touching things because, you know, if the fabrics weren't good, they weren't going to hold up well, they weren't going to launder well, and that's another thing we do at Russo Ross. Most everything in the store, I would say 98% of the store, is machine washable.
Oh.
Because, you know, we don't want that, you know, extra expense and hassle, mm-hmm. or whatever. We find that our ladies are very particular. They don't like wool. So I think there's a lot that goes into clothing besides how it looks in a picture. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to touch it. You have to feel it. You have to try it on. Or you're probably in for a lot of hassle.
Right. Are you in the St. George area? I was curious, being on Jefferson. Where
no,
are you?
No, the store is not. The store is in Baton Rouge.
So you avoided that whole,
yes,
controversy.
Yes, we did.
I've been listening with interest. Growing up here, I remember when St. George was just out really in the boonies, you know, in the 60s and 70s, and the town's grown so fast.
Yes, it's certainly a lot different than when we attended LSU. It's amazing.
Yeah,
amazing.
Yeah.
Especially the revival of downtown, and, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of good things have happened in Baton Rouge. Of course, the bad have been well documented, but a lot of good things have happened,
right.
too.
Now, Chris, when we kind of reconnected, when I asked you to come on the show, we were talking about the cost of going to college and the cost of going to LSU. And I looked up, when we were there, we were paying $160 a semester. And I know that makes us sound like dinosaurs, but honestly, we're not. But I looked it up in today's dollars, and it would still only be $775. To put in perspective how much, you know, college education has gone up. And I know we were both lucky to get to go to college when we did, when the state really financed our education.
You're so right. In those days, you were able to, quote unquote, work your way through school,
yeah.
because it was reasonable. And a lot of people, I'm sure some people had student loans, but student loans weren't as Mm-mm. nearly as prevalent as they were today. And now, of course, kids that get out of college and are facing, you know, the job market and a huge debt, I mean, it's really sad.
Right. I know I was upset when I started law school in 1980. I think it was $684 a semester, and I had to borrow money to put myself through school. But looking back, what a blessing. You know, today I'm not sure if I had the same circumstances. I just don't know. I know I wouldn't have the same choices.
Well, one thing, again, talking about the good that the state has really stepped up to the plate with is its community college system.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's helped to bridge the gap in some cases as well.
Yeah. Over in the Lafayette area, we've got Dr. Natalie Harder, who's over quite a large, you know, several parish area. And they're offering so many certificates where you can start out with, you know, $50,000 a year job with benefits and not having to go into deep debt. So I'm a big proponent of that. But it makes me laugh when I think back looking at our pictures. Who knew that we would take the paths we did and end up, you know, one of us an attorney? I never thought that. And I had no idea about your career in journalism, how long you had been a
publisher.
Yes,
it's been really a lot of fun. that my days at the Advocate, I have a lot of fond memories of that and working for the Manship family. Not only, I guess, people today know them for Channel 2, but also know them for their great philanthropy. I was fortunate enough to work for Doug Manship Sr., a remarkable man. So that was a great experience to work for the Manship family. Working with Wanda Horn at In Register was crazy, too. It was, you know, it looked like a glamorous job, you know, covering parties, being a social editor, so to speak. There was a lot of hard work in a monthly publication. So people ask me a lot, well, not so much after 8 years, but in the beginning, do you miss it? Do you miss that life? And no, I didn't miss, because it was, you know, it was night and day. A lot of times it was 6 or 7 days a week. Don't miss that lifestyle. Do miss my nice long lunches, though. Well, retail, you don't get those.
Yeah, weren't you known as the hat lady?
We did. We wore hats.
Both of y'all.
We were, that was our trademark. There was a magazine in Baton Rouge before In Register called The Register. A very infamous character named Doreen Muse started The Register in the late 40s, and she was known for her crazy hats. Of course, in those days, lots of ladies wore hats. I mean, it was standard. But now, well, when we started in 89, no one wore hats. So it was a good entree. It was good branding for us. Mm-hmm. It let people know when we came to a party who we were, what we were doing there. So it worked out really well.
Where are the hats now? Did you
Well, I have, like, I would say, like 250, 300 hats. They're at my house.
Really?
Yes.
A closet, a room?
they're in a closet, yes. I have some wonderful hats and hat boxes that ladies actually donated to us. You know, historic hats, beautiful hats. I have a Christian Dior applique beret from Paris.
A beret?
Yeah. So, I mean, we just kind of became a depository for hats during that 20-year period. So that was a lot of fun, too. It was definitely, we definitely were in touch with so many people from the community, and that was one of the real joys of being the publisher.
So both my girls, Taylor and Kelly, were represented in the Lafayette area. And they both had to wear hats, you know, for Mardi Gras. And I have to tell you, that's fun, picking out hats. So, Chris, I think we have a caller. Oh, we don't. Excuse me. Oh, I thought he was saying something. See, this is what I'm saying. It's not as easy as it looks. But my girls had to select hats, and we had so much fun. We went to Yvonne LaFleur in New Orleans.
I was going to say, and she made custom hats, right?
She made custom hats.
Finding hats is really a difficult thing these days. Mm-hmm. To find a real beautiful hat is something you don't see a lot, at least in South Louisiana.
She makes it fun for everybody.
Absolutely.
To look elegant. So, well, we're going to take a break in a moment. Chris, when we come back, why don't we talk about Ted Kergan's story? You can talk about your book.
I would love to.
My Brother's Keeper. Thank you for being with us. We'll be right back after the break.
Signature support for Talk Louisiana comes from Brian Lowe Financial.
Welcome back to Talk Louisiana. This is Jan Swift, filling in for Jim Engster. And we're here in the studio with Chris Russo Blackwood, the author of My Brother's Keeper, a 30-year quest to bring two killers to justice. If you'd like to call us, our number is 877-217-5757. So, Chris, again, we were talking about the synchronicity of life, reconnecting after all these years, being friends. And I'm actually a friend of Ted Kergan, who's, I think he's the largest Sonic franchisee in our state and one of the largest in the country. He experienced a horrific death in his family. His brother was murdered. First he was missing, and then they determined that he had been murdered. And you met Ted, I think, through your friend Ann Edelman, who's here in Baton Rouge.
I did. I met Ann shortly. The murder case was revived in late 2012, and Ann and I were having just one of our regular luncheons when she was being alerted that the killers were being rearrested at that time. And I just sort of plunged into the whole thing, following her lead, and she got involved innocently enough to sort of help Ted Kergan, as she had worked. They were friends, and she had worked with him before, and she got involved just trying to handle media when the case was reopened, which she thought would be, you know, 2 or 3 days worth of work. And instead, she was involved in of course, still being a good friend of Ted's, she was involved for 5 years along with him as this case progressed into its conclusion, which was in 2015. So it was a 2015, yeah.
Yeah. After reading the book, what I was, the first thing that stuck out to me was that one of the investigators was Hiller Moore. Back in 1984, early '85.
That was one of the crazy things about the book. There were a lot of people who were involved in the case in the 80s and who still were around today. One of the investigators in the case, as you mentioned, Hiller Moore, was the crime scene investigator. Mm-hmm. And he was actually at the murder scene back there in the early 80s when this murder happened. And he would be, of course, the DA, the district attorney, when the case was reopened.
Right. There was some federal monies that brought cold cases back to the forefront. And this was when DNA evidence had become a common thing. But back in the 80s, of course, there was no way to analyze the DNA evidence of blood or remnants.
You're correct. And so the killers were let go. They were released. They were not able to directly link the crime to them. And as you mentioned, Ted Kergan knew and felt that they were responsible, and he spent the next 28 years compiling evidence, working with private investigators, and you know, completing this timeline of he knew exactly where these two people were the whole 28 years. It was incredible.
And what was really incredible was they had the people, as you said. They found the two that ended up being the killers. But our DA at the time was O.C. Brown, and he was on his way out. And so the new, and he was going to prosecute these two people. But with the new, I think it was Brian Bush, was the incoming DA.
That's right.
Since there was no body, he determined there was no evidence.
Much to Ted's surprise and a lot of other people's surprise, Brian Bush's office decided not to go ahead with the prosecution of the case. And all, you know, this was just a huge, you know, I can't really speak to enough about how crazy that was, because you know everything had been go on moving forward with the case, and then it was just dropped. Mm-hmm. Everybody dropped it except Ted, of course.
So decades, 28 years went by. Over $1 million was spent. Excavations were done,
and a young lady grew up, Memory Tucker, whose father was in business with Ted Kergan, knew, you know, she was a child. She was eight years old when Gary Kergan was murdered. But, you know, all through her life, you know, she was there when her dad was involved in early on in the 80s, when right after the investigation started taking place. And he, you know, was involved with Ted trying to gather information of their own. And so in her mind, she wanted to become be in law enforcement. And she did. Mm-hmm. She did. And she was actually one of the people who was responsible, had looked over and was responsible to bringing that case to the forefront of the cold case division when it was opened and given money. And by the way, that case was the only case that was pursued and prosecuted during that time. There was no more money available. The grant was not renewed. So that case, another synchronicity, was the only case.
Right. Well, I hope Ted Kergan will listen to this segment that we're taping, because without his investment, his personal investment, his financial investment, and his tenacity, they never would have been brought to justice.
Well, there's no doubt about that. Assistant District Attorney Dana Cummings was hugely responsible for it, too. She was, of course, I was present for most of the court proceedings. She was brilliant in the courtroom. Of course, the confession by, confessions, I should say, by Lila Mulla, one of the murderers, was really crucial in moving this case through the conclusion. She testified against Ronald Dunnigan, who was the other murderer, and he was sentenced to life without parole. He's in Angola currently. She's also serving a 30-year sentence. And is currently, well, she was incarcerated at Louisiana Correctional Institute for Women, which, as you know, was flooded in 2016, I believe it was. Anyway, she has been moved to another facility, but she, of course, is still serving time as well.
Right. Well, for anybody just tuning in, we're talking with Chris Russo-Blackwood about My Brother's Keeper, Ted Kergan's 30-year quest to bring two killers to justice in the killing of his brother. One of the lines in the book, Chris, I know this is where you got your title from. This is Ted Kergan talking after he spent almost 30 years of his life to find his brother's body. And he said, "One of my goals has always been to find my brother's body and to bring him home. It's like the story of Cain and Abel. Am I my brother's keeper? Yes, we are our brother's keepers." How many of us would spend our lives, even if we had $1 million, I'd probably be spending them on clothes, you know, but back to the first segment, but how many people would do this? But I recently interviewed Ted on my podcast, Discover Lafayette, and he said, I would do it all over. He wasn't going to give up, and he's still looking for the body.
Well, yes, I think you go right to the heart of the matter. How far would you go? And we use that over and over in the promotion of the book. How far would you go? You know, we all like to think we would do that. And even if we had the resources, I doubt if a handful of people, I don't even think a handful of people would have gone to the extent that Ted Kergan went to. With, you know, not only investment, but of himself, investment of time. And he left no, I mean, really, this sounds so cliche, but he left no stone unturned. I mean, he went down every road interviewing people, as I said, sending private investigators to interview people, himself driving down road after road and, you know, from New Orleans and points north of Baton Rouge, just trying to track down any leads he could, getting in touch with the most esteemed professionals in forensic matters and that kind of thing to come and bring them here, all kinds of things that no one would have done. Even if they would have had resources, I don't think they would have had the ability. And Ted put together a team, which included Ann Edelman, as you said, who worked on this pretty much night and day. Pretty much night and day. It was remarkable.
What strikes me about Ted Kergan is his humility, but also, you know, that's why he's successful in business. He's tenacious. And I want to ask you, you met him through Ann. You got to understand the case. When did you know, I've got to write a book about this? How did that come about?
I'm glad you brought that up, because I didn't get involved to write a book. I got involved through Ann. We're good friends, and she said she would bring up bits and pieces of the cases to me and say, let me get your opinion on this. I'd like to look at it through different eyes, through, you know, fresh eyes. And as I got more and more, you know, it was just completely all-encompassing. I got just threw myself into it because it was so interesting. And Ted's enthusiasm and just all out, you know, let's go, let's find it, let's get it. And putting together a timeline was pretty incredible because it involved a lot of people, a lot of places. As far as we know, Ronald Dunnigan and Lila Mulla did not speak to each other again after the murder. So they led totally separate lives in different areas of the country, different, obviously, families. Lila Mulla had two children and a husband at one time. So it was just putting that whole storyline together was fascinating. And the more the synchronicities played out, as I mentioned, you know, the Hiller Moore, who had been on the crime scene, the case investigator who had also been on the crime scene. I mean, it was just over and over these synchronicities. And so I finally was like, somebody needs to write a book. Who's going to write this book?
And it's me.
Oh, yes, it would be me. So, yes, I didn't get involved for the idea of, oh, I'll write a book about this. But as it progressed and further down the line and meeting, and I did get to speak to Lila Mulla twice while she was incarcerated, and how she thought, and became so intertwined with everything. I felt the story had to be told.
Well, I see your book, My Brother's Keeper, was published by wildbluepress.com. So what was harder, writing the book or getting published?
Well, actually, I sent a query to an agent, and as we talked earlier, the how far would you go? You know, you say you'd spend all these resources and all this time to find the killer of your brother, but would you really? So my query was sort of along those lines, and I got a call from an agent within 24 hours. So it was very intriguing to her as well. My agent, Charlene Martin, of Martin Literary Agency out of Seattle, was very interested in it. So actually, the writing the book was the hard part, but getting published was fairly easy for me.
It was meant to be. So I know we're all grateful for the time you took. If anybody's interested in buying this book, I know it's on Amazon.
Yes.
My Brother's Keeper, A 30-Year Quest to Bring Two Killers to Justice by Chris Russo Blackwood. I want to thank you for joining us today, Chris.
And
I want to
thank
Jim Inkster for giving me this opportunity. Thank you.